Hello and welcome to this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lab. And before we get into the news of the day, which is quite significant, Rex, there is something that I wanted to get ahead of. A story. I do not want this to be picked up in the British tabloids, potentially the Sun. But I was supposed to join you for a Golf Today roundtable on Wednesday afternoon. Instead, got a call from our daycare saying that my three-year-old daughter had, quote, live bugs in her hair. This was not like her in like the Tinker Garden and suddenly getting dirty. Yes, they did indeed found lice. Turned out my five-year-old had it as well. Wife and I both got treated and tested. And so I had to cancel that roundtable appearance. And now I'm $400 poor. And with 3 hours of my life, I can't get back. It was not a roundtable that you appeared on. Fortunately for you, it was just one segment alongside conspiracy theorist Eamon Lynch and the sweetest woman alive, Anna Whiteley. How did your TV appearance go without me? Is just going three wide.
It was empty without you. I'm the one that had to break the news to Eamon and Anna, who you're right is the sweetest person on the planet, sitting next to Eamon. There is a dichotomy there that you can't cut with a knife. And they didn't know your story, so I probably betrayed a lot of trust in you by giving that story away. I'm surprised. And she asked me at the end of the segment, well, where is Lab? And that's where I kind of panicked. I'm glad you brought this up, because I didn't know at that point. Now we're starting to talk about HIPAA laws. We're starting to talk about minors. I was like, oh, no. And so I lied on national TV, on cable TV, on little TV. I lied and said, oh, he's just feeling under the weather, some sniffles, and then tried to downplay it. Because, again, I thought it was funny. I wanted to share it with Eamon, specifically Eamon, because he got the biggest kick out of it. Of anyone, everyone, and other than me, because I enjoyed it thoroughly. Having three kids myself, three boys myself, and I've gone through this numerous times. So that's why I thought it was so funny. I don't think it's funny because poor Lily, trust me, I feel terrible for Lily, your daughter, didn't deserve that. But it was quite panicky for me for a moment, because when I didn't anticipate her asking, and I think she thought it was like public information, and maybe it is, maybe you put it on the X and the Twitter machine, I don't know. But I had to lie to a national audience. I apologize for lying. The reasoning why is obvious.
It certainly is obvious. Did not know that this was discussed on Golf Today. I'll probably have to speak with Eamon about this one. He did crack a joke saying, how can someone with a receding hairline have lice? Which I thought was well done on his part. I must say, having now gone through the experience, lice is far better than like hand, foot, and mouth or pink eye, both of which are disgusting and highly contagious. This one, you knock it out. They'll be back in school on Thursday, for which I am very grateful. Let's get to the news of a day, which again, it is quite significant that we are recording this, Rex, on Wednesday, November 6th. That is 24 hours after Election Day here in the U.S. Donald Trump will be the 47th president of the United States. And Rex, somehow, even it is way, way, way down the list of priorities for an incoming president, this decision by the American people could actually have a significant impact on the golf world, right?
You're not going to be surprised, but that was one of the questions that Eamon had ready for you and I, and I had to bear the brunt of that since you decided to go ahead and skip and take a day off from work. And my response was probably not what he wanted to hear, because my response is, I see where Rory is coming from, and that's kind of who started this when he was asked about in an interview over on the European tour what he thought about. It was a question that had to do with the negotiations between the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia and the PGA Tour. And he did make the leap that this is probably good for those negotiations, pointing out, first and foremost, the Department of Justice investigation, which it was always going to be a hurdle. It was always going to be an impediment to any type of potential deal. It's not guaranteed that there'll be an investigation by the DOJ. And even if there is, there's no guarantee that they would find that there is any antitrust violations. As I was explaining to a friend of mine this week, monopolies aren't illegal. The NFL is very much a monopoly. Where you start getting into legalities is if you are said monopoly and you decide to use that power and that force to keep anyone else from coming and competing with you in a fair manner in the free market. So I don't even know. I'm not going to connect those dots, because my point on Golf Today was, my guess is the incoming president will have plenty of things on his plate to deal with well and beyond golf and trying to reunite the professional game. The one part that Rory did say that I think does have some credence is Donald Trump, whatever you think about him, he loves golf and he wants to be involved in golf. And so I've always said, and I said this for when he had his first term as president, that it is good for the game. Again, whatever it is you think about Donald Trump, I understand. However, I don't think it's going to have any impact in what's going on right now as far as the negotiations.
Probably can't hurt. I thought the Athletic's Gabby Herzig laid it out pretty well in a recent story there. Rory, you're speaking of his press conference on Wednesday in Abu Dhabi. The word he used was amenable, that the Department of Justice could potentially be more amenable. And it could be a huge moment for golf civil war with Trump in office for a second time. He also thought, Rex, that the president of Elon Musk in Trump's inner circle could help get the deal across the line. Didn't quite follow that one, but I'll have to take Rory's word for it. Obviously, the Department of Justice, and Rory has mentioned this multiple times, is part of the transaction committee that's negotiating directly with the Saudi Public Investment Fund, would be one of the main obstacles, as well as player resistance. He sort of cited as 50-50 in recent months, players who would actually want this to go through. But the DOJ obviously would be highly interested in any potential merger, particularly after Jay Monahan, the PGA Tour commissioner's initial remarks when the framework agreement was first announced in June 2023, that a deal would be, quote, taking a competitor off the board. That one triggered alarm bells among the Department of Justice. Rory's point about Trump being in office can only be a good thing is well put, because Trump is pro golf. He's pro live golf. He's pro deal that would see a predominant circuit and all of the best players in the world together again. He said in a recent podcast with broadcaster Jim Gray and Bill Belichick, the former New England Patriots head coach, that it could take him about 15 minutes to hammer out a deal between these two warring sides, even if that is a little bit ambitious. But you look at sort of the tentacles of the story. He and his family do have relationships already established with the Saudis. He has hosted 6 live events on Trump courses. Again, it could, I repeat, could help the investigation, but the same characters are going to be involved. The same principals are going to be involved in the DOJ. And again, it's not going to be a chief priority on January 20th when Donald Trump gets back in the Oval Office.
It's important to point out that the current Department of Justice investigation has been going on for over 2 years now. This happened long before the framework agreement was announced last June. This started even really before Live Golf. There was rumblings, there was rumors. So it's kind of two separate things right now. I understand why everyone is wanting to connect these dots, but what the DOJ is doing has more to do with it. And I've spoken with people who've been interviewed for this investigation. And the conversation always seems to go back to the world ranking. And that seems to be where the Department of Justice found issues with how the tour handled Live Golf. That it seems to me they were using the world ranking, and probably correctly so, as sort of this roadblock to being allowed into the ecosystem. That all being said, there's no even guarantee that this investigation is something entirely different than what would likely happen if and when there is a deal. That's an entirely different investigation. So you need to keep that in mind first and foremost. The DOJ is not inclined to just investigate mergers between foreign companies and American companies. That's not what they do. That is more of like an SEC type thing. So this doesn't have anything really to do with what's going on right now. It's important to point out. It's also been brought up that maybe they would be concerned about certain security concerns. Again, that's not a DOJ issue at all. That would fall on another body of the American government. First and foremost, the U.S. Senate. They held hearings last year with the idea being, yes, they're worried about security concerns if there is a deal between the Public Investment Fund and the PGA Tour. Again, not sure where that came from, but that's the idea. So I don't want to, I feel like connecting these dots is too far. That's why I wanted to stop at Donald Trump clearly loves golf. He's clearly passionate about golf. He's also a businessman who likes to do deals. So I get those two sides of it, but the DOJ thing is a little out there.
The U.S. president can rearrange or reassign the priorities of the Department of Justice. I think that's why some people are making the leap, where all of a sudden he could just snap his fingers. I know it does not work that way, but he could rearrange the priorities of the Department of Justice.
But my point is, I keep going back to this, that the current investigation has nothing to do with a potential deal between PIF and PGA Tour. So what's going on now has something entirely different. It is something entirely different than what may or may not happen in the future if there is some sort of deal. And you're right. The president probably could step in some form or fashion and either make that go away or dull it a little bit. But right now, what's happening is something that really has nothing, that probably wouldn't even interest the president, to be honest with you.
Very interesting, nonetheless. Certainly a topic that's not going away anytime soon. Since we're talking about this, Rex, what about the reported deal that was reported over the weekend by The Sun? I was having a hard time figuring out exactly like the U.S. equivalent to what The Sun is. It's not quite like the National Enquirer, but it's also not quite a reputable source like the New York Post would be as well. What are you hearing on, again, if you guys missed this, The Sun reported over the weekend that a deal between the PGA Tour and the Saudi PIF is done already. What are you hearing on that front?
As you mentioned, our conspiracy theorist friend, Eamon Lynch, decided to go in a little bit different direction when he asked me the question. It wasn't so much about the story and any facts to it. Is there any credence to what's happening? And the short answer is nobody really knows. What he wanted to talk about is sort of the state of journalism and golf. And this has nothing to do, first and foremost, with David Facey. He's the author of that story. You and I both know David. We're not friends with him, but certainly there is a level of respect there. So I'm not coming at David Facey with this at all. I think if you wanted to find a good comp, it would probably be maybe the New York Post, where you're right, it's not the Enquirer, but they do color outside the lines that you would expect.
Get a little fast and loose with J school rules is what you're saying.
And so the conversation with Eamon went in a slightly different direction because there are no sources. The story was based on no named sources whatsoever. There was also some glaring mistakes in this story. First and foremost, he said the deal was between the PGA Tour and LIV Golf. That's not the case. We've been through this 1,000 times. LIV Golf has nothing to do with this. He also said that ultimately the deal that this story reports on would be voted on by the PGA Tour membership. That's not true either. That's not the way this works. So you can kind of pick it apart. I think the bigger issue, and I think you and I would probably see eye to eye. You went to a very good journalism school in Georgia. I went to a very good journalism school at the University of Central Florida, both winners last Saturday. I want to point out, when I look at a story like this, two things stick out. One, the fact that there are no sources. Two, in that situation, I'm going to ask myself, does the writer have any way of knowing someone in the universe that would know these facts? And in this particular case, Facey probably does. I would give the nod to him. He's a longtime journalist on the European side, covers the tour very, very well. The second question, and I'm not sure this one with this story passes muster with me, is why would someone, and we both know, everyone knows, that these negotiations are being kept in a very, very tight circle. There's a handful of people in the world that actually know what's going on. And most of those people have no interest whatsoever in talking about it publicly right now, at least until there is some sort of deal. So what would be the motivation of someone that actually has information? What would be their motivation to get this out there? So I can make the stretch and say maybe one of the sides or both sides wanted to send up a trial balloon and decide, okay, let's just see what the public would say about this particular deal and see if it's going to pass mustard. That one doesn't hold up to me either, because I think all of us can speculate. First of all, we know what the tour's going rate is. I mean, when they did the first investment with SSG, the line was set at $12 billion. That was the evaluation of the PGA Tour. So we know that line. And we know SSG came in about $1.5 billion with an option for another $1.5. And that's about what? Maybe a 10, 11% stake share in whatever this new entity.
11 was what the
deal said. Yeah, 11. And so this story says that PIF would come in with 1.5 and it would be another 11% share. Where it kind of gets sideways a little bit is when you start talking about board seats and who's going to be the chairman. Something is going on. I've had multiple sources tell me that there is movement on this side. The fact that Jay Monahan was in Saudi Arabia last week for a convention and that he met with the governor of the Public Investment Fund, Yasser Al-Rumayyan, those are all good steps in the right direction. I think our colleague Bob Herrig on SI probably said it best, that it seems a little premature right now. And the part that I did appreciate is it sort of outlines what this could actually look like. And that's what we've all sort of been dancing around for a long time now. But this is what it could actually look like. So that part of the story I did enjoy. The rest of it seemed a little light.
Yeah, and it was just heavy on the financial impact, not necessarily what it would mean in terms of the reintegration of LIV players into the ecosystem, whether they're playing PGA Tour events, PGA Tour players going to LIV, et cetera. For what it's worth, Roy McIlroy, who again is a member of the PGA Tour's transactions subcommittee that's negotiating directly with the PIF said that he hasn't, quote, heard a thing regarding a potential deal, even with Monahan in Saudi Arabia last week. He did, however, say that the transaction subcommittee is convening on Wednesday night, and maybe some news will come out of that meeting. Speaking of Rory, Rex, he is playing this week in Abu Dhabi. He's not just giving press conferences. He actually is going to play golf. First time he's played in, I believe, 4 weeks. I was struck by this, reading through his transcript and listening to some of the other interviews that he gave on Wednesday. The unique approach that he is taking to change his golf swing and potentially, if it all works out, win a third consecutive order merit title on the DP World Tour and the sixth one overall. At the end of a long year, he took 3 weeks off from playing on the golf course, and he has essentially just been banging balls against a simulator screen. He is not seeing the ball flight. Like, it's not an actual simulator where you can see the shape of the shots based on spin rate. He's literally just staring there at a TV monitor, if I'm understanding him correctly, and just sort of ingraining his swing feels and his motion. Perhaps this is a common strategy and technique among the world's best players. I can't recall an instance where a player said he did this for 3 weeks, did not see a ball flight for 3 weeks. He was in studios first in Florida and then even in New York for a couple of days, but he's trying to get his swing back on track, trying to sort of narrow and tighten his dispersion. Are you buying it, Rex? Was this the miracle fix for Roy McIlroy to get to the sort of play that we know he's capable of?
The way he described it is he wanted to focus on the body motions, what he's doing with his body, trying to make it more efficient, trying to make it hold up under the pressure. The idea being is he's given away some really, really good opportunities. He's found a lot of ways to lose this year, going all the way back to Pinehurst. Certainly the Irish Open is another example, that BMW PGA just a few weeks ago. These are all events that he easily could have won and wasn't able to do it. And I think you and I both can agree with the idea that, look, I don't have any more respect for anybody more than Rory with the way he never stops looking for ways to improve his game. A game that's really, really good, by the way. So I'm always impressed with some of the things he does and how he shows up and sort of the honesty that he'll show. I remember being in Dubai a few years ago when the winds really came up and he essentially lost his swing one day. And we didn't see him again maybe until Torrey Pines a few weeks later. And when he showed up, he kind of went into detail. You remember this. The idea that that proved to me that I had something wrong with my swing, that when the winds got up, I wasn't able to control my golf ball, and that's unacceptable. All that being said, I don't understand this. And here's why, as I just pointed out, he's kind of lost some opportunities here that he should have won. It's not his ball striking, I think, is the reason that he lost those opportunities. Strokes gained off the tee, he was fourth this year on the PGA Tour. That's pretty much status quo. He's lost some spots in approach play, so his iron play isn't quite as sharp. But that's not the problem either. I think both of us would agree his putting has been the problem. If you look specifically at the U.S. Open, if he makes an exactly 75 inches, not feet, 75 inches of putts over the last three holes at Pinehurst, we're not having this conversation. He doesn't lock himself in a room. We're not even talking about maybe the swing needs to be a little bit more efficient or a little bit more compact or a little bit more dependable when the pressure comes up. I understand where he's coming from. He's looking for answers. I just don't think digging them out of the dirt or digging them out of the mat, maybe is a better way of saying it, is the right way to do it this time, because that's not what cost him, certainly at Pinehurst and even the Irish Open. You can look at the putts he missed coming down the stretch more so than the shots he missed.
I mean, at Pinehurst, he was near flawless for 68 holes. And then he coughed up the two-shot lead with four holes to play and ended up losing to Bryson DeChambeau. I see where he's coming from, because you can't just pin it all on clutch putting or putting under pressure. And that was clearly the fault that he had over the final hour at Pinehurst. I think when Roy steps back and looks at the current landscape in golf and what separates him from a Scottie Scheffler, a Xander Schauffele, a John Rahm, even Colin Morikawa now, who has seen a nice resurgence, it is the consistency of the ball striking. And Scottie Scheffler in particular, he almost never, ever loses strokes gained to the field with his ball striking. Like, it's once in a blue moon. And Rory can have these swings where he gets hot with the putter, gets cold with the putter. He's great with the driver. He's a little shaky with the driver. He's missing right with his irons. He's sort of fighting like the pulls. He has that consistently. He's consistently inconsistent throughout the calendar year. And I thought it was very interesting for him to note that this was the rare time in the golf year where he could actually do this, where he said he's been so busy over the past 18 months. And I know the PGA Tour has recently shifted to this January to August to give guys more of a dedicated break following the team event. If you're an American player like Scottie Scheffler, we're not going to see him for essentially 2 or 3 months. But for Rory, he plays internationally. He's trying to win the Order of Merit. It's always been important to him. He really struggled to carve out that time. And when you do that and you're just sort of playing, it's more band-aids as opposed to actually addressing the issue. And for him to do it 3 weeks of dedicated just hitting balls into a screen, sort of refining his movement, refining his body motion, and then getting out on the golf course for the first time last week, and now playing 2 consecutive weeks, this week in Abu Dhabi and then next week in Dubai, that is then going to give him an additional 7 or 8 weeks before he kicks off his 2025. That should be plenty of time to actually bed in some changes that, again, he has not felt like he's been able to do over the past year and a half. I think it's a great move for Rory. And based on some of the input from some of the swing folks that I trust who know a lot more about the golf swing, they can already see a difference in how Rory is swinging and moving during the practice rounds in Abu Dhabi. And I'm very curious to see how he's going to play this week.
Who do you trust? Just out of curiosity with the golf swing. Like, who are you bouncing this off of?
Luke Kerdenine, the golf instructor for Golf Digest. He talked to Rory about his swing. Rory told him that he gets two across the line at the top. This was in a recent interview that he did with Golf Digest. Two across the line, the move that he is now doing, which stems from a better takeaway, has it more pointed down the line as opposed to across the line. That should help with sort of the right misses that we've seen so consistently with Rory over the past couple of months.
Well, and essentially that's what Chris Como did with Xander. When you look at whatever it is that transformed or transpired between those two over the last year and led to this career year for Xander, when you talk to Como and to Xander, you get the same answer, that there was a looseness at the top of the swing, for lack of a better term. He was across the line. That's not necessarily a bad thing until you get into a bad position on the way down. So it seems to me that Rory saw something he liked probably in Xander to go down this path. And I'm not even saying it's a bad path, because I think, again, he's a world-class player. He's a sublime ball striker. I can't imagine that's going to change that much. The only thing I'm questioning here is I really don't think it was the swing that cost him coming down the stretch. Certainly at Pinehurst, and I would even go to the Irish Open. Now, the BMW PGA is a little different. I mean, Billy Horschel made an eagle in the playoff. That one's kind of tough. You pretty much lost that one. But I don't think it's necessarily – you can always clean up the swing. You can always get 1% better. That's what players at this level do. But I don't think that's the problem.
I mean, I think he's trying to reduce the variables. And the reasons why he would potentially crumble under pressure, right? Like, there's a reason why he has not won a major championship in 10 years. If you can sort of shore up the golf swing. And Brandel Chambly, to his credit, has been saying this for years. Mm-hmm. He has been saying for years that he needs to clean up the top of his backswing, stop getting so across the line. It's why he's never been a consistent wedge player. It's why he's an incredible driver of the golf ball. But he's always going to struggle with the short irons in that position at the top of his swing, because he has trouble then dropping into the slot and sort of avoiding that right dip. And it's that lazy sort of like right shot that has doomed Rory on so many occasions. And it's the main difference, if you look at Scottie Scheffler's proximity to the hole versus Roy McIlroy's proximity to the hole from 150 yards and in. Like, it's a stark difference between those two players. Mm-hmm. And so if this is what Rory has diagnosed is the problem, and he has gone through, again, it's a pretty unique approach to doing so, not looking at the ball flight. And Rory was pretty self-aware, saying, hey, if I'm on the range and all of a sudden I see hooks or I see cuts or I see worse, I'm going to start to make compensations in my golf swing. And so he realizes that about himself, knew that he could not see it, and has gone through that way. And now I think he has his golf swing in a spot that he enjoys more. And again, it's he called it, quote, a work in progress, I believe was the exact phrase. He's going to play this week in Abu Dhabi, next week in Dubai, two places where he's had plenty of success over the course of his career. I think it's really interesting, because if he does sort of find something with his golf swing and then can bet into it more over the next month or two away from tournament competition, I think it's wheels up again for 2025. We could have a very exciting battle on our hands.
I'm with you. I'm fascinated by what this means and what he's trying to do and how he's going about it, because this is vastly different than what we run into with most PGA Tour pros. And I will say, I understand it from the perspective you just pointed out what Brandel says about Rory's swing. And I feel like he said it enough that there is, I think most people in golf are going to agree with that. However, there's also the idea, and I remember going through the lab at TPI many, many years ago, and they had sort of the 3D digital breakdown of all the different swings on the PGA Tour. And they showed me Rory's and the X factor, which is how much torque he can turn, how much he can turn 2 to 3 more degrees than most tour players. Forget about amateurs, most tour players. So that's how he ends up picking up that power. As a result of that, his body needs to move a little bit quicker to sort of clear out, to leave room for this downswing to get it in that slot, as you talked about. I think with Rory, more so than any other top player, if something is off with his body, it's going to have an impact on his swing. Another thing that Rory talked about that I did want to ask you about, and I know you've seen this, was the idea of, he was pretty much asked point blank, like, why does the race to Dubai mean so much to you still? Like, you're trying to win major championships, you're trying to win the FedEx Cup, you're trying to be competitive on the PGA Tour, and yet you always come back to Europe. And he pointed out he wants to hold the all-time record. He wants to catch Monty. I think he's two titles behind it back in the day with Monty did it. It was the Order of Merit. Now it's the Race to Dubai title. I am fascinated by that because I don't think there's many other players in the history of the game that would give a lot of thought to that. I guess the example would be, not to pick on Scotty, but I don't know that Scotty's digging through the history book trying to figure out who's won the most FedEx Cups. It's going to be Tiger Woods. And how can I be? Is that right? Is it going to be Tiger? Or is it going to be Rory?
Rory. Yeah. It's Rory.
Sorry. Yeah, I had to think about that one for a minute. I don't think it doesn't really resonate with a player like that. Even when you factor in money titles, so that would be Tiger Woods on the PGA Tour. I don't think most modern players put that much thought into it. And maybe it's because we've been conditioned to, this is more about major championships, this is more about legacy. But that one was a little strange to me, but I do appreciate it.
Now, a cynic would say Rory's focusing on trying to win a FedEx Cup title. Rory's focused on trying to win the Race to Dubai title. Rory wants to be known as the best European golfer of all time because, again, he has gone 10 years without a major championship. Scottie Scheffler's not thinking about how many FedEx Cup titles he's going to earn at the end of the day because he's so dedicated and focused right now on winning major championships, because he is winning major championships. He knows every single time he tees it up in 2025, he has a great chance to win the golf tournament. Rory is looking to bolster his legacy in other ways. If, God forbid for Rory, he does continue to go years without winning and adding to his major collection, which again still sits at 4 major titles, you need other things in order to sort of justify all the work that you're putting in and to feel good about the work that you're putting in and to sort of stake your claim as one of the best players of his generation. I can see exactly why he's doing it. I understand why he's doing it. I think it's smart that he's doing it. And I'm sure in some of the meetings with sports psychologist Bob Rotella is saying, hey, look at all these other things that you were able to accomplish. Look at all these other things that you can still accomplish. Your year, your worth cannot just be about 4 major championships a year. There's more to golf. There's more to the sport. There's more to your career. There's more to your legacy than just those 4 events a year. I can hear him saying that right now. And I think it's smart for Rory mentally to sort of adopt that similar mindset.
When you said that it was good that we were doing this on Wednesday after such a historic day, I actually thought you were talking about the first CFP rankings.
I mean, I don't even care about that. Like, there's still so much football. There's still so much football that has to be played. The only reason they wait this long, actually, I don't even know why they waited until Tuesday election day. It's not like there was other things to watch on Tuesday night. The reason they even have preseason rankings, Rex, is just for ratings. They juiced the ratings to see that these teams, wasn't Florida State ranked in the top 10?
Yes.
In week 0, we see how that turns out. Like, the things are fraudulent. The fact that Georgia's number 3 based on their schedule, based on who they still have to play at Ole Miss this week, home against Tennessee next week, is utterly ridiculous. I don't put much stock in it. Where is UCF in the current rankings?
They're not in the rankings. UCF has had a very, very difficult season. We finally got a win on the board after some really, really bad losses against Arizona last week. And I was at that game for exactly 5 minutes because the person I went with, one of my neighbors, was like, hey, let's go out. And his son goes to UCF. My son goes to UCF. So I hung out with them before the game a little bit. And the second it started raining, We could not leave that stadium fast enough. That's how bad of fans we are. I did not sign up for that. I'm sorry. I'm not going to do it. And I was looking through. I won't bore people with text messages. But that was about one of the most miserable Saturdays you've had in a long time, based on just this string of angry, spewing venom text messages that you sent me.
I mean, I hate saying this because I love the Dogs. I watch every minute of every game and have for a very, very long time. This might be my least favorite Georgia team ever. Like, they're just so maddening. They're so frustrating. Oh, Carson Beck was going to be potentially the number one pick in the draft. Back-to-back games now with 3+ interceptions. Mykal Williams was supposed to be potentially the number one pick in the draft. I feel like the announcers aren't calling his name at all. Like, where's the stars? And look, they may very well still win the national championship. Right, they could still be SEC champion, and they could blow through the playoff. I just don't see it. It just seems like every single game is on a razor's edge. I have a sneaking suspicion they're going to lose one of these two games coming up again at Ole Miss this week in Oxford, home versus Tennessee.
Trap game
the week after that. No, because they're both very good. There's nothing trappy about it. Like a Florida, a loss to Florida would have been a trap game because Florida is mediocre at best. And Georgia will be looking ahead to these two top 20 teams. No, there's nothing trappy about it. It's like a very difficult schedule. And that's just the reality of the situation. I'm just hope that a second loss for Georgia would not completely doom their playoff hopes. That's my hope at this point.
Before we get out of here, my guess is you don't want to talk about fantasy football either, right?
You can take your victory lap. Go ahead.
Nope, not going to take the victory lap. The funny part was, and I wasn't able to pull it all together in time, but the two trade offers, I think there were two trade offers you offered me last week, right?
I mean, I send so many, it's literally hard to keep track of them all.
And I delete them immediately. That's what took me so long to actually find them. The player you wanted to trade for is the reason I actually beat you in fantasy this week, which is why the reason they even bring this up. It's why I don't do trades with you. Because you only have your best interest at heart when you offer a trade.
No, I try and find trades. If you are a good fantasy football player, you're trying to find something that makes both teams better. In, for instance, if I have excess running backs and you're RB needy, like we should work out a trade that suits both of us well. I'm not going to bore folks at home
with this
rant, but man, I always go wide receiver heavy. And this year has just every single wide receiver who is worth a darn in fantasy football has gotten hurt. Just one after another. My strategy is backfiring, but the best players do and will persevere. And folks, that is the limp brisket way. All right. That is going to do it for this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav. Rex and I'll be back next week for full recap of the happenings in Abu Dhabi on the DP World Tour, as well as the Worldwide Technology Championship on the PGA Tour, the third to last event on the fall slate, and whatever else comes up over the next week. Thanks for listening. Thanks for the support. We'll talk to you guys next week. Have a great rest of your week.
Angry Tito.